Only a parking violation. Absolutely, officer, we'll be on our way shortly. He turned away with a sniff, then turned back.
You are human?
We are, I confirmed. Dolph sniggered. These back of beyonders couldn't even tell humans by looking at them.
Have you ever been to, Ponce de Leon?
He pronounced the name of PDL, one of the big five worlds of humanity united, with the same care that I would use if trying to speak Kroof. A few times, I said cautiously.
Are you aware of any cargo ships bound from Ponce de Leon to Grongo?
I put on a puzzled face while my relief curdled. They were looking for us.
This one would be, a very large ship, much bigger than that pile of junk of yours, laden with very valuable technology. Oh, yes. It would have an armed escort.
I said. Come to think of it, I may have seen exactly such a ship on the pad at PDL. The captain boasted that he had a personal commission from the Generalissimo. I had done just that, but only to make the regulars at Snakey's Bar and Grill laugh. As for an armed escort, we were our own armed escort. I admit to dropping the ball on the Silveradon patrol ship. I just couldn't blow those little guys away. They said it was only a customs inspection, and I was dumb enough to believe them. It was a 60-ton tri-engine Phantom with an extended cargo bay. Does that sound like the one? Lord, strike me down now.
Yes, that must be it. Do you know when it departed Ponce de Leon? It is delayed.
At about the same time we did, I said. I should think it'll arrive any day now. We would have got here on time, but I took it extremely slow at the end. You do, with a leaky antimatter containment loop. The little Kroof went on his way, beaming. You could expect a warm pat on the head from his commander for bringing news, even if it was just hearsay, of the missing cargo ship. We finished our supper with no appetite. Kroof food is vegetarian. Dolph can usually eat anything, but even he left half of his stringy hash browns. We paid up, stooped to get out of the dining room, and crawled down the hall to the front door. Outside, the air was soft and sweet with the smell of probably carnivorous flowers. Clint, the driver, said, "Were they looking for you?" "Gosh, I can't believe you worked that out," I said. My mask of politeness was slipping, as I knew we were up to our necks in excrement. It couldn't take even the Kroof much longer to work out that the ship which had just crash-landed in their desert was the one they were yearningly awaiting. I left Dolph to transfer some extra GCs to Clint to convince him to drive through the night instead of parking up here as we had planned.
"I gave him some extra to keep his trap shut," Dolph said as we returned to our perch under the landing gear.
"He'd better. We'll be spending the rest of our lives in a jail with 5-foot ceilings if the Generalissimo's enforcers catch up with us."
"Humans ought to stick together in places like this," sighed Dolph. "Maybe I should go back and scare him."
"No, don't. Paying him off was the right move."
"I just hate to think of him spending our money."
It was my money, actually, as both of us knew. I appreciated that Dolph was trying to smooth things over between us by being fiscally responsible. In his own way. I said, "Just imagine him spending it on his personal harem of Kroof bimbets." Dolph shuddered, I chuckled. Of course, there was a glitch in this pretty picture of human solidarity. If Clint, or anyone else on Garongal, figured out that we weren't human, not like they were human, we wouldn't even have that. Neither of us shifted that night. Even though it would have been more comfortable to curl up in the form of an animal on the hard, cold bed of the crawler. I knew I wouldn't get any sleep anyway. 3. The flatbed crawled over the mountain pass as dawn was breaking. The corded flanks of the mountains dropped away to forest. Further down, a strip of green and blue cropland bordered the sea. The prevailing winds clearly dumped all the rain on this side of the mountains. The trees lining the road looked like actual trees, not predators.
The only thing that spoiled the view was the carbuncular rash of concrete on the coast, the city of Karplui and its spaceport. We rappelled into the ship's forward airlock to get breakfast. When we came back out, the view was unchanged. Good old Clint was not risking his rig on these steep roads by traveling any faster than 20 kilometers per hour. It took us a whole day, well, a human standard day, the Gorongolian day is 38 hours long, to reach Karplui. In the forest, we kept getting hung up on low branches, and on the ring road around the city, we kept getting hung up in traffic jams. Or rather, causing them. A 100-meter flatbed carrying a spaceship does tend to do that. Dolph hunted tarantulas inside the ship to blow off steam. I messed around with my computer, trying to find out where we would get the best price for our bananas. I already foresaw that we would need to spend big to get off this planet before the Generalissimo twigged our breach of contract. By now, every mother-loving cruelth on the continent knew that a crashed spaceship had been transported to Karplui today. We picked up speed on the modern 10-lane highway to the spaceport and rumbled past it. The height of the flatbed allowed us to see over the sound baffle fence. Tarmac stretched away to the diamond thread of the sea.
One,
Dolph said.
Two,
I disagreed.
One, and it was just an Ek tanker.
I was counting the airplane. That was the sum total of the craft that had landed and or taken off from Karplui today. I counted the airplane because I thought it might come to that. Even a trip to somewhere else on this planet might turn out to be better than sticking around. While we were stuck in traffic jam number 903, I had seen a gang of those secret police types apprehending a cruel driver. With hollow points. It took me right back to Tech 10, where Dolph and I spent the most, shall we say, active years of our military careers. I had zero wish to revisit the era of my life where I killed people, and less than zero wish to be killed myself. The flatbed turned off the highway, following the curve of the spaceport fence. Another fence appeared on the other side of the road. Beyond it, curvilinear metal shapes gnawed the afternoon clouds.
"Here we are,"
Clint yelled back from the cab. I jumped down. It felt good to stretch my legs on the gravelly red dirt. With Dolph a few paces behind, I marched up to the gate of the scrapyard, which was locked. I stretched out my finger to the buzzer and froze. On a bulletin board beside the gate, covered with perspex against the rain, above a lost dog notice and a circular for the biannual human community barbecue, my own face stared at me from a full-color poster. Michael Mike Star Runner, wanted for grand theft and lese majesté. 100 GC reward. The bold black text was written in English, Cruelthian Nek Shetalon. Dolph nudged me.
To get your name wrong.
I'm deeply insulted.
You should be.
He was cracking up so hard he could hardly get the words out.
100 GCs. 100?
For reference, I spent 200 GCs the last time I took Lucy for pizza on PDL. The Generalissimo valued my life at less than the worth of a deep-dish Hawaiian pie. But, as funny as it was, to the Cruelth, 100 GCs was obviously a lot of money. The relative paltriness of the reward would not deter them from going for it if they connected me with the man on the poster. Dolph said,
"The Cruelty is longer than the English."
He twisted his head sideways. "Cruelty is written from top to bottom."
"That last line?"
He was no longer smiling.
"Think it means dead or alive."
Now, that really makes my day. If I couldn't get off this planet pronto, I would never get to take Lucy for pizza again. Never see her smile, never hug and tickle her again. She'd be alone in the world. That thought lit a fire under me. I touched the pocket of my donkey jacket and made sure my midday special was still in there.
"The cluster-wide reps must have dropped us in it,"
Dolph said bitterly. "No," I said. "The Generalissimo's just freaking out because his cargo's late, and was now on Silverado. They paid retail for that stuff, remember? 300 thou. That's probably the equivalent of their entire planetary GDP. Nice place to settle, if you've got a GC-denominated income,
Dolph said, looking around at the sticky-leaved blue bushes that grew up against the fence. The flatbed's treads had crushed some of them, and they smelled like marzipan. Large insects buzzed around us.
Not.
It wasn't the cluster-wide guys anyway, I said. I gave them a fake name. I was even gladder of that in a moment as the gate concertinaed open a few feet. In the gap stood a human with a scowl on her face.
Are you Will Slaughtermore?
My own lame-ass humor struck me as both puerile and risky now, but I straightened my back and shook her hand with a smile. That's me.
Crash Hardlander.
Dolph grinned, elbowing past me for a chance to squeeze her grease-stained hand.
You must be Jerry.
Yep, like it says on the sign. Jerry Scarvarchi's Ships and Parts.
Scarvarchi doesn't sound like a human name, so I had been worried that Jerry would turn out to be a Kroolth. As a human, she would be less likely to turn me in for the princely sum of 100 GCs. That was something. The other thread of hope I clung to was that the clean-cut, handsome young man on the Wanted poster did not look much like the scruffy, stubbled, not-so-young chancer facing Jerry Scarvarchi now. They'd used the picture from my pilot's license. Years had passed since that was taken, and last night was far from the first time I'd slept, or rather, not slept, rough. Independent freighter captains are known to be hard-living, penny-pinching losers, so I hoped that was all she'd see in me. In one sense, it was a shame. Miss Jerry Scarvarchi had the body of an angel, imperfectly disguised by a mechanic's coverall and the face and hair of a shampoo model. I fixed my eyes north of her neck and said, Theo and Annette from Clusterwide may have told you I'm looking to sell a damaged ship. I'm not gonna lie to you, the containment's gone, she'll never fly again.
Yeah.
However, I hear you'd be interested in buying her for scrap. Long pause. Jerry's gaze scanned the 100-meter metal swan hulking over the trees behind me and Dolph.
Sure,
she said at last.
Happy to take her off your hands.
She raised her voice without moving.
Clint, put her over there!
Roger,
Clint yelled back. The flatbed ground forward a few meters and the robotic handler arms unfolded. My ship swung over our heads and over the fence of the scrapyard. We heard it hit the ground with a crunch. Dolph flinched. It was a no-brainer from Jerry's point of view, of course. Totaled or not, my ship was a long-haul sky mule. Those don't come along on a world like Gorongal every day.
Come in,
she said with about as much warmth in her voice as a lox tank.
And show me what I just bought.
We waved goodbye to Clint and followed her into the scrapyard. I took her on a tour of the ship, inside and out, pointing out all the high-spec features such as the 360-degree radar LIDAR, the gimbaled retro rockets that enabled VTOL, and the three-way microwave-slash-oven-slash-sous-vide cooker. I did not point out the coil gun, even though that was the most expensive bit of kit on the ship, and I could have used it to justify a higher asking price. She would find it later when we were safely off-world. Most indie freighters do not have military-grade cannon, and I wanted her to think we were in no way special. She was impressed enough anyway. I could see her ripping the cockpit apart with her eyes, and I figured we were home free.
All right, come on over to the office and we'll talk,
she said when we were back on the ground. Meanwhile, Dolph was ripping her clothes apart with his eyes. I whispered, down, boy, as we followed her through the scrapyard. It was a jungle of dismembered spacecraft and airplanes. A grinding, screeching noise impinged on my ears as we walked. I glanced to my left and saw a handler robot 3 stories high, with tractor tires and 4 hydraulic arms piling the junkers on top of each other.
We remove the resellable components and then sell the airframes for scrap,
Jerry explained over the racket.
There's an Eck outfit comes and takes them over to the compactor.
She waved at the distant cab of the handler bot. The motion caused her breasts to rise enticingly under her coverall. I wasn't staring or anything. Of course not. Dolph was, unashamedly.
There's got to be a catch,
he muttered.
Babes like that don't work in places like this.
Sexist, I said, but he had half a point. The handler bot stopped work. A Kroolth emerged from the cab and spidered down the access ladder. It joined us as we reached a shack attached to a hangar-sized workshop in the middle of the scrapyard. Jerry pushed the door open and removed spaceship parts from chairs, including one very small one. The Kroolth came in and sat on it.
This is my husband, Jerry said. Opist, these are the guys that Annette rang about.
Husband? Dolph's jaw was on the floor. I realized mine was, too, and picked it up. Great to meet you, Opist. I kept talking to cover up my astonishment and consternation. With a Kroolth in the picture, our odds of being turned in for the 100 GC reward had just rebounded. I'm the owner of the Sky Mule out there. I've just shown Jerry your features, and I'm sure you'll agree 400 KGCs is more than a fair price, considering the resale value of her parts. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. I paid 500,000 GCs for her new. Well, second-hand. Actually, third-hand, but who's counting? Dolph put on a sad face, suggesting that I was practically giving the ship away. But what we had both forgotten was that with a Kroolth in the picture, our odds of being ripped off had also increased astronomically.
Noah,
said this little shyster.
You have added too many zeros, yes, by a factor of 3. We will give you 500 GCs.
500? I spluttered. Jerry smirked.
No one wants to buy a Sky Mule on Grungle. We cannot even sell the parts. We are doing you a favor. Yes.
But she's got a sous vide cooker, I said, desperately trying to keep the tone light. Dolph did not help me haggle. When I glanced around to see why he was being so quiet, apart from the shock of finding out that Jerry was married to a Kroolth, I caught him looking out the window behind Jerry's desk. It faced the back of the scrapyard opposite to the way we'd come in. The sea sparkled far off. In between the sea and us stood a number of spacecraft. Some of them looked fairly new, at least from this distance. Dolph leaned back into the conversation and coughed in a jackally kind of way.
How about a trade-in, he said.
4. Our negotiation stalled with 3 zeros between what I was willing to take and what the Scavarchis were willing to pay. Coming around to Dolph's idea of a trade-in, I agreed to a stroll outside to look at the second-hand ships. Dolph lit a cigarette as soon as we got outdoors. Sometimes you do have good-ish ideas, I told him. Unfortunately, this is not one of those times. What are the chances any of these junk heaps even fly?
You never know, he said.
The Scavarchis walked ahead of us. Opist had to take 2 steps for every one of his wives. His head came up precisely to her shapely waist.
How do they do it?
Dolph whispered. Do what? I whispered back. Run a business while criminally stiffing their suppliers? Very profitably, I expect.
No. It.
I had been trying to stop my imagination from grappling with the particulars. Now my efforts failed, but so did my imagination. Same way we do?
It's gotta be this size, Mike.
Dolph held up his pinky finger. Beats loneliness, I guess.
Well, maybe.
Dolph perked up.
They aren't really married. It's a front, so guys won't hit on her.
Try hitting on her and see what happens, I suggested. Dolph sighed. We passed a Gravex and a void breaker. Up close, airlock hatches sagged, the sky stabbed through rust-eaten fins, and toxic fluid dripped from neglected piping. A family of bustard-like birds flew out of an engine bell, wings whirring. It was my turn to sigh. None of these lemons could come close to replacing my ship. My customers would take their business elsewhere with good reason. My competitors would laugh their asses off. Lucy's little face would crumple. And then she'd try to cheer me up. That was the worst thought of all.
Hey, Mike,
Dolph murmured.
What about that one?
Don't call me Mike, I hissed. It's Will Slaughtermore, remember?
He must be spinning in his grave.
I actually borrowed the alias from a guy we knew in the Special Forces. He lived up to it. I hoped I wouldn't have to. Opist and Jerry were heading away from the ship that had caught Dolph's interest, intent on showing us another Grav-X that was sitting precariously on the edge of a marshy creek. I caught up with them. What about that one? I pointed.
Oh, you do not want that one,
Opist said, speeding up. My antenna tingled. If Opist didn't want us to want that one, I wanted it. Can't hurt to take a look, I persisted. Jerry said something in Krulfi, Opist replied. The conversation sounded to me like this. Zip churik kist ach zipt. Yeah, but dikku shidzdra.
Oh, okay, if you want,
Opist said grudgingly. The ship stood a stone's throw from the boggy area where the creek ran into the sea. A smell of rot came from the tall, pampas grass-like plumes growing in the bog. The ship was definitely in better shape than any of the others we had seen. However, it was a design disaster. About the same size as my late lamented ship, it lay belly down, with two large wings angled back from its flanks, ending in what appeared to be floats, and two small wings dangling like flippers from the fuselage. It had no fewer than 5 engines, a cluster of 3 at the tail and 2 more at the bottom of what the Army would call the rigid core assembly, a.k.a. the fuselage. Strikingly, its nose cone, raised off the ground, was not actually a cone but a rounded oval that split open along several blunt serrations, gaping at the sky like the jaws of a plesiosaur. If I did not mistake my guess, that was an energy cannon protruding from the jaws like a cheeky tongue. Long before I was the owner of a shipping company with bills to pay and a daughter to provide for, I was just a guy who loved spaceships. That guy had been in hibernation for quite some time, but for some reason, this weird and wonderful ship woke him up. I stepped up to it and ran one hand along a sun-warmed jackstand, feeling like myself again for the first time in ages. Dolph, also staring raptly at the ship, murmured,
"Fugly as heck."
"Yep."
"It looks like one of those extinct things they used to have on Earth. Those, what do you call them?"
"Dinosaurs."
"The ones that swam."
"A plesiosaur."
"Yeah, that's it. Mike, we gotta have it."
I had made fun of Dolph's emotional attachment to our old ship, but now I was feeling the same way about this one. I would never again mock him for caring too much about a hunk of metal. The truth was, he'd stayed young at heart, and now I felt young at heart again. I nodded enthusiastically. I can already see it landing at the PDL. The guys will think someone put LSD in their coffee.
"And look at all that cargo space."
"Look at those engines, Dolph." I could tell from the ovoid mouths of the 2 lower engines that they were air-fed. "I bet she can go hypersonic in atmosphere, breathing atmospheric oxygen, and then transition to rocket mode, burning onboard fuel supplies. The main drive clusters, probably a set of standard thermal hydrolox plasma engines, but look at the size of them. Depending on where her wet mass tops out at, I bet she does 0.5 acceleration over short distances. Maybe even 0.6.
"Need a cold shower, Tiger?"
Dolph pretended to fan me. "We gotta get the specs without appearing too eager," I said, more to myself than him.
"Oh."
"What?" He pointed to the top of the ship. I had thought the plesiosaur's long neck was just a truss. Now I saw Jerry kneeling on its top edge, waving down at us from 5 meters above our heads. She was leaning down, so her cleavage threatened to spill out of the V of her coverall, which had somehow come unzipped a short way. Dolph groaned under his breath.
"Hey, guys,"
she called.
"Come up and see the airstrip."
She wasn't joking. The top of the truss was an honest-to-God airstrip, dashed line down the middle and everything.
"It even has arresting gear, fighter jets sold separately,"
Jerry said as we walked aft along the shockproof flexible tarmac. I hated to think how much mass this added to the ship. I decided I'd remove it.
In my head, the ship was already mine. Dolph said,
Who the heck would put an airstrip on a spaceship?
It was a good question, and would have been a better one if he had asked it to her face rather than her cleavage. Jerry didn't seem to notice. Her mood had taken a turn for the friendlier.
The Kroolth would, as you see.
This is a Kroolth ship? Dolph said.
I just said so, didn't I?
I didn't know.
Dolph trailed off, but I knew what he'd been going to say. I didn't know the Kroolth built spaceships. Suddenly, however, the airstrip made sense. Kind of. It was only 60 meters long and no wider than a king-sized bed. You couldn't land a fighter on that, arresting gear or no arresting gear. You could, though, if the fighter were Kroolth size. That left the original question of why the heck anyone would put an airstrip on a spaceship in the first place. Jerry answered it.
This is actually the one and only Kroolth spaceship. The flagship of the Imperial Kroolthi Space Fleet built by the X on Port Aronim in orbit.
I breathed an inward sigh of relief. The Exhelitons, or X, made the best spaceships in the cluster. If they had built this one, I could count on solid manufacturing quality.
There's no native shipbuilding capacity on Gorongal. There's an assembly plant on Silverado, but, well, you know about that situation.
I nodded. Did I ever?
Since it was his first spaceship, the Emperor wanted it to have everything. Thus, we have the runway.
Jerry gestured to the rear wings with their oddly fat tips.
We have the floats.
She pointed down.
We have the caterpillar treads.
Caterpillar treads, I echoed, getting more googly-eyed by the minute.
Yeah,
Jerry said.
It's a spaceship. It's an aircraft carrier. It's a tank.
She almost smiled.
Kind of like your microwave-slash-oven-slash-sous-vide cooker thing?
That never really worked, I admitted.
Maybe not. But this does. The X wouldn't have let it out of their yard unless it passed all their tests. Hell, they charged enough for it.
So what happened to the rest of the Imperial Space Fleet?
Dolph said, struggling to keep a straight face.
The Generalissimo happened to it.
Jerry waited a beat.
Do you guys know anything about Kroolthi history?
Our faces must have told her, truthfully, that we didn't.
A Condil begat Urzip, who begat... Sorry, the bit you care about is the last year. The Emperor of Gorongol and Legate of Silverado, Princeps of the Many Moons, etc., had ideas about making the Kroolth a spacefaring people. He started out by building the ship we are standing on. But it came in at 300% of budget. You know how the X are, and people were pissed. The Generalissimo, who used to be the Emperor's army chief, put himself in the middle of the anti-space movement and used the public anger to stage a coup. Off with the Emperor's head, in with twice-daily choruses of the new national anthem, and a bonanza for the suppliers of ugly gilt picture frames and tiny motorbikes.
Dolph laughed. Jerry frowned. Despite her ironic tone, I could tell that these recent developments disgusted her.
The Crown Prince made it to safety on Silverado. They're still loyal to the Imperial family out there.
I was thinking that if I had bothered to find this stuff out before we came, I would still have my ship. I would have delivered my cargo to the unsavory Generalissimo and have been on my way with a spring in my step and money in my pocket.
So that's how things stand right now,
Jerry finished.
We would be in the middle of an interplanetary war, were it not for the fact that the Kroolth have no spaceships.
Except this one, Dolph said.
Jerry nodded.
Except this one. But the Generalissimo thinks spaceflight is a waste of money, remember? So he sent it away to be scrapped.
But you never scrapped it, I said, finally understanding.
Opist couldn't bear to do it.
A softer note entered her voice.
He keeps thinking the Crown Prince will come back and want it. But those biker assholes come around here every so often asking what's taking so long, accusing Pizzy of being an imperialist. They pistol-whipped him a couple of months back. Next time they might do something worse. The only thing that's protecting him is that I'm human, and that's not surefire, you know. So I want this...
She ground her boot heel into the airstrip.
Damn thing gone.
Lady, I said.
You won't even have to pay me to take it off your hands.
Sod off,
she said with half a smile.
I'm still keeping your Sky Mule.
A fair trade.
All contents included.
Not a problem, I said. An instant later, Dolph kicked me in the ankle and mouthed, bananas. His head may have been turned by Jerry's strategic display of loveliness, but it was less turned than mine was by the thought of possessing this overpowered beast. Crap, the bananas. Oh well, it wasn't as if we'd have a chance to sell them anyway. All contents included, I assured Jerry.
Great,
she said, finally giving us a genuine smile.
Let's go back to the office and we can file the paperwork.
At which point I'd have to tell them my real name, if I wanted the ship legally registered to me. I decided to risk it. My real name isn't Star Runner anyway. Of course it isn't, come on. When was the last time you met someone named Star Runner or Hardlander, Dolph's actual nom de guerre, who'd been born that way?
There's another ground access ladder back here,
Jerry said, clambering down past the arresting gear.
That door is the hangar. It's sealed so you can either keep it in vacuum or pressurize it to extend your livable onboard space. This right here is the airlock to the engineering deck. There are three airlocks total. Each of them is flush with the hull and retracts into it, like so.
She slapped the pressure plate. The ship had power. The hatch opened, releasing an unpleasant smell of decay.
So you don't have to mess with outwards opening hatches that could be vulnerabilities in a combat scenario. Did I mention the weapon systems? A CP cannon, a keel-mounted railgun, and a tailgunner's turret with a large-caliber coil gun.
She enumerated the specs of the weapons. She was really selling the ship now, as if to impress me what a great deal I was getting. She didn't need to, I was past sold.
Hey,
Dolph said.
What's bit pizzy?
Opist was running toward us, weaving between the second-hand spaceships, shouting in cruelth. Jerry stiffened for a second and then started down the ladder at dangerous speed. I was about to follow her when I saw several more Krulth pursuing Opist. They wore black, like the secret police types from yesterday, like every wannabe badass in the entire freaking cluster. My hand dropped to my midday special. An amplified voice blared in English.
Mike, Star Runner! Mike, Star Runner, we know you are there! Come out with your hands up, or we will toast you. Ah, yes.
My instincts took over. I dived into the open airlock of the ship like a rabbit down a burrow. 5. Dolph dived into the airlock half a centimeter behind me.
They didn't mention me,
he grumbled.
I feel unwanted.
Are you really jealous? I panted. Really? We were in a Krulth-sized chamber. Dolph's elbow wanged into my eye, my knees were crushing into his stomach. Somehow I managed to close the airlock. Hopefully they hadn't seen us dart in here. The chamber was too small to stay in. We crawled out of it into a corridor whose ceiling was all of 5 feet high. I had forgotten the interior of the ship would also be Krulth-sized.
Shift,
Dolph said. Shift, I agreed. We stripped off our clothes, folded them in the airlock chamber, and shifted. Dolph became a jackal. It isn't his favorite form, but he only has two, and the other one is not appropriate for spaceship decks. Well, I've got a bunch of forms. Most of them have bad memories attached. I went with my current favorite, a white tiger. Mainstream humans always want to know how shifting feels. My answer, if I ever wanted to gratify their prurient curiosity, would be something like, have you ever had a root canal? Now, multiply that by an order of magnitude and imagine your whole body is a nerve. The bones, muscles, blood vessels, everything has to drastically realign. No way that's not gonna hurt. However, you get used to it, and when you're old hands like we are, it only lasts for a few seconds. We shook it off and padded along the corridor, which was now just the right height for us. Or rather, we were the right height for it. In animal form, you have a better sense of smell. This allowed us to experience the full rancidness of the odor of decay that pervaded the ship. My enthusiasm went off the boil a bit, but I had more important things on my mind right now, such as putting Garongol in the rearview mirror for good. The engineering deck turned out to be high enough for a human, or even an Ek, to stand up straight, owing to the amount of space required for a 5-GeV antimatter containment loop. We might as well not have bothered to shift, after all, but neither of us felt like shifting back just now. The secret police assholes were still out there. Emergency lighting in the form of pink LED strips edging the hatches and control panels saved us from having to blunder around in the dark. I headed straight for the antimatter drive. It was a standard gray, heavily rad-shielded Taurus with two smaller C-shaped units clamped onto it, what the Army calls electromagnetic force generation assemblies. You and I call them big honkin' magnets. A cruelty-induced failure in one of these magnets was what had doomed my late ship. The bastard Silveradans had tried to steal it. While cutting off its anchor points, they had, predictably, given the level of cruel technical expertise, broken it. Without a strong enough magnetic field to contain it, the antimatter inside the loop had inexorably started to annihilate itself. This is what we call a leak in the loop. The process of annihilation progressively wrecks the inside of the Taurus until it's unusable. 400 kgc's down the drain. The drive accounts for 90% of the cost of your average spaceship. This was a brand new drive, manufactured to Ek quality standards. It even still had a sticker on it saying it passed rad safety testing. To my delight, the console in front of the loop, at face height to my tiger form, indicated that the magnets were currently generating a field and 13.5 trillion positrons were whizzing around in there right now. I said the drive accounts for 90% of the cost of a ship, but the fuel costs as much as the drive. "Dolph," I said in a choked voice, "I estimate that we have 500 kgc's worth of antimatter on board. No, make that 550, the market's been going up." Tiger and Jackal each lifted a front paw and performed a clumsy animal high five. "Screw the Generalissimo.
Plus 3 tons LH2 and 1.5 ALOX,"
Dolph said, gloating over the tank gauges. "Oh yeah, baby, we are out of here." In my mind, I was already landing the new ship on Ponce de Leon, swooping Lucy into my arms and giving her the grand tour of our funny-looking new cash cow. She was going to absolutely love it. The corridors were even child-size. I had not had a proper look around the ship myself yet, but I already felt as if I knew her inside and out. Which just goes to show what I know.
"I said Jerry to keep the power on," Dolph mused.
"They expected the Crown Prince to come back and claim it any minute, remember?" I felt a twinge of guilt about waltzing off with 500 kgc's of antimatter that belonged to the cruelty imperial family. But Jared said it, contents included. She'd almost insisted on it. Funny, that. There was a pause. I knew Dolph was also thinking about what might be going down outside between the Scavarchis and the secret police. I studied the array of screens on the wall console, wondering if I could get an external camera feed.
"Smells a bit in here, doesn't it?"
Dolph remarked. "Something probably died in the ducts," I said, recalling Irene's mice. My lasting irritation at our weapons officer had evaporated. She was going to love this ship as well. All those guns. I found an optical feed, got a picture of the sandy ground underneath the fuselage, and swiveled the trackball clumsily with the pad of my right forepaw, trying to see behind the ship.
"It was a dog,"
sighed a squeaky, whiny voice. Dolph let out a string of high-pitched yipping barks. I emitted a coughing roar. We leapt in the air and spun around all 4 feet off the ground, searching for the source of the voice. I wanted my midday special so much it hurt, but it was back in the airlock with my clothes, and you can't fire a gun with paws anyway. The pink-tinged shadows now looked threatening. Light glinted off something moving in the darkness behind the containment loop, where coolant pipes threaded aft around the antimatter injection nozzle. I crouched down low, tense to spring.
"It crawled into the number 3 engine bell and got stuck," sighed the voice. "I attempted to coax it out, but it was afraid of me. Thus, it died. It was a very sad event.
I was able to remove the corpse using one of my remote attachments, but I fear the smell lingers. Not that it bothers me, of course.
The speaker walked out of the darkness. Walked is not exactly what it did. It had three short legs like a chicken's underneath a suitcase-sized triangular body. It moved with a plunging, rolling gait. Several robotic appendages of assorted lengths dangled from its housing. They sprouted various tool attachments, including what appeared to be a laser drill. A screen on top swiveled to face us, displaying a sad face emoji. All the fur on my back stood up in a bristly ridge. A menacing growl dripped from my jaws. Logically, I knew I could not hurt this thing with claws and teeth, but logic wasn't in the driver's seat right now. Memory was. I had seen things like this before. On Tech Thin, they worked as mercenaries for the X. They were supposedly on our side, but I swear they killed more humans than the Necrosphere did. Dolph probably guessed where my head was at. He paced in front of me, putting himself between me and the drone.
"So, this is what she meant by contents included," he growled.
The drone rocked back on its rear legs, its front two robotic attachments jerked up. The emoji on its screen changed to a crossface.
"More animals,"
it exclaimed.
"Shoo! Shoo! Out, little dirty feet!"
It moved towards Dolph, brandishing its laser drill. So much for its story that the dog had died because it got stuck. I remembered the lost dog notice on the bulletin board outside the scrapyard. I shouldered Dolph aside. "We're not animals," I growled. "When was the last time you heard an animal tell you to saw it off, Chrome Brain?" The drone's screen displayed an OMG emoji. The ones on Tech Thin didn't have screens like this. They just had guns mounted on top.
"Shifters,"
it gasped. "Got in one." I batted the laser drill down with a heavy paw. The drone rocked on its stubby legs. "I'm a shifter, and I just bought this ship." I remembered that we had not actually completed the paperwork. That reminded me of Jerry. I disciplined my gaze to stay on the drone and not drift over to the optical feed screen. "I have no intention of sharing it with a drone, so out. Out, little dirty feet," I drawled, borrowing the thing's own phrase.
"My feet are not dirty. I have maintained the ship in perfect order."
It actually was so clean, apart from that smell, you could eat off the decks.
"I'm very efficient, friendly, and cooperative,"
the drone went on.
"I was hired as the weapons officer, but I prefer to see myself in a more generalized role,"
its screen simpered.
"I like helping."
"I just bet you do," I muttered. "Whoa," Dolph said, alarmed. I followed the jackal's gaze to the optical feed screen. It was displaying the feed from a camera that must be mounted amidships on the port side. Opist had just appeared in it. He was tottering towards the ship, wearing a suicide vest. It looked like a bulky canvas waistcoat, but as with the drone, I'd seen such things before. The look of appalled terror on his small face also gave it away. The secret police surrounded him at a safe distance, aiming their rifles at him. Jerry knelt behind the half-circle of Kruth. Blood shone bright on her cheek. One of the vicious little thugs was holding a gun to her head.
"Oh, dear,"
the drone said.
"It appears that the Junta's Volunteer Auxiliary Technology Control Police have lost patience with Opist. They intend to force him to board the ship, whereupon they will detonate that explosive device, killing him and destroying the ship."
It displayed a new emoji, a face with a tear on one cheek. "Shut your face, drone," I snarled. The trouble was, the drone's read of the situation matched mine. We were done for. Unless. "We're taking off," I said. "Now." I didn't want to take the drone along, but forcing it off the ship would take more time than we had. Opist was 20 meters away and closing. I hunched my tiger shoulders and closed my tiger eyes, bracing myself to shift back while mentally calculating how long it would take me to reach the bridge, figure out the controls, and initiate the drive. I thought I could just about make it.
"No,"
said Dolph. I opened my eyes. The jackal stood in front of me, all bristled up to make himself bigger. In nature, jackals are a lot smaller than tigers. However, Shifton conserves mass, so Dolph's jackal was nearly the size of my tiger. He was looking me in the eye. Have you ever looked a jackal in the eye? It isn't an easy thing to do. Even when the jackal is your best friend. Especially when it's your best friend.
No, Dolph repeated. We're not leaving them to die, Mike.
The thought flashed through my mind. Easy for you to say. You haven't got any children. But he was right. Of course he was right. Lucy needed a father who was a real man. That guy who loved spaceships, he was also the kind of guy who'd never have left Alpist and Jerry to die. That guy was me, and I acknowledged it animal style by swishing my tiger's tail in a menacing rhythm as I padded back to the optical feed screen.
Look at Jerry, Dolph said. She's bleeding.
Yes, she was bleeding, but her face said she was angry and frightened for Opist, not herself. Even at this distance, I seemed to see something in her posture which didn't match the situation. Oh, I thought. Of course. All right, I said as Opist staggered to the bottom of the airlock ladder. Here's the plan. 6. Opist climbed towards the airlock. The bulk of the suicide vest deformed his torso. Clumsy with fear, his feet slipped on the rungs of the ladder. The thugs watching from a safe distance jeered, yet I was impressed. The little Krul's face was set. He wasn't crying or cursing. He thought he was going to die and betray his emperor in one fell swoop, yet he hoped that he could save his wife's life by making this sacrifice. So he climbed the last rungs of the ladder without hesitating, and set one knee on the lip of the airlock. The thugs yelled in excitement. I picked out the one holding the wireless detonator. He was dancing around triumphantly, earning a look of contempt from the kneeling Jerry. I filled my lungs with fetid swamp air and let out a tiger's blood-curdling roar. All the Krulth froze, sniffing the wind for the scary predator. Their beady eyes fixated on the source of the sound, the pompous grass clogging the mouth of the creek. I had exited from the rear airlock of the ship, shown to us by the reluctant drone, and circled around, as stealthily as only a big cat can. While all eyes were on Opist, I'd stalked closer to the ship, edging forward on my belly through the mud and roots. Now, while the Krulth were off balance, I charged out of the pompous grass, straight at Opist. Insensate with terror, he toppled off the airlock ladder right in front of me. Perfect, except for the fact that the guy was wearing a bomb. I pushed off the ground into a desperate leap and intercepted his fall. Mentally saying a prayer to my patron saint, I caught the suicide vest in my jaws. It did not explode. I hit the ground running. Keeping my head high so Opist wouldn't bump along the ground, I turned and dashed back towards the groves of thick, tall grass, carrying Opist in my jaws like prey. The cruel thugs stared in shock, drawn together into a defensive knot. Their cute little hostage plan had not anticipated the sudden appearance of a dangerous predator. What's more, a predator unknown on Gorongal. They had no way of knowing the predator was me. Of course, Opist didn't know it was me either. He struggled weakly as I charged into the grass. The sickly sweet smell of the explosives in his vest stung my tiger nostrils. I noted the bunched wires connecting to a detonator in the small of his back. As I splashed through the muck, I chewed through the shoulder of the vest. I'd gambled on the Krulth being too astonished to trigger the explosion immediately. That bet had paid off, but they wouldn't stay confused forever. Good thing Dolph was on the case. As I waded deeper into the bog, I heard a deafening rat-a-tat-tat behind me. Rounds zipped through the grass plumes. About 1,000 little birds started up in terror, it seemed like from right under my feet. The drone had assured us that the turret gun was loaded. Thank God it had been telling the truth. Now I just needed Dolph to get it turned round the right way. With grass plumes falling on my back, rounds whizzing over my head, and my paws sinking into hot, gloopy mud, I dropped Opist. He immediately ripped the suicide vest off over his head and flung it into the grass. He had a good arm. It traveled at least 10 meters before it vanished into the bog. I cringed, bracing for the explosion. All I heard was Dolph wasting more ammo. Opizd turned to me, his thin arm spread. He was 4 feet tall and unarmed, facing a tiger. Yet he was ready to fight for his life. Never say that evolution can't be beat by spirit.
It's me, I said urgently. Mike, I mean, Will, oh, never mind.
He blinked, then he said,
They know you are here. Oh, I am sorry when they threatened Jerry, I told them.
That's all right, I said. They would have figured it out soon anyway.
Jerry,
he moaned, jumping in a vain attempt to see over the grass. Of all of us, she's probably the safest, I said cryptically. Then I crouched lower. I normally never do this, but hop on. Opiz didn't hesitate. He flung his leg over my back and grabbed hold of the fur at the scruff of my neck. He weighed no more than Lucy. I bounded through the swamp, heading away from the ship. We got far enough away to save our lives before the suicide vest blew up. Muddy water, pieces of fish, and clods of earth with grass still attached flew over our heads in a lumpy hailstorm. It had been a pretty big bomb. I waded out the fallen mud and then ran on. Opizd hammered a little fist on my shoulder.
Jerry! Jerry!
Opizd might be worried about his wife, but I wasn't. Admittedly, our masterful, spur-of-the-moment plan had all the hallmarks of a classic Mike and Dolph production. Start running and fighting, let the bad guys fall where they may. We had not built in any leeway for rescuing Jerry, but I had a feeling she didn't need rescuing. There was more to the gorgeous scrapyard manager than met the eye, and I had bet that as soon as the cruel thugs didn't have the drop on her, she'd be able to take care of herself. I would have won that bet if there'd been anyone around to take it. When Dolph stopped firing, I left the cover of the swamp and circled back between the ancient, now bullet-riddled, spaceships. Sure enough, as I approached our plesiosaur, Jerry rose from a crouch and dropped the two body-armored cruel thugs she'd used as a shield. The cruel that Dolph had missed had been put down by the energy pistol in her hand, a small, sleek thing with a nasty green glow at the nose, small enough to fit in her cleavage. I'm a sucker for a dangerous woman. I nearly fell in love with her on the spot. However, this one was spoken for. I halted and let Opizd slide off my back. He sprinted up to his wife. She picked him up, and they kissed passionately. I averted my eyes and saw Dolph standing on the airlock stairs. He gave me a thumbs up. Then he made a googly-eyed face at the loved-up couple. After a few more seconds, he pretended to check his watch. I coughed. I still had my tiger's cough, although I was so muddy there could be no trace of my tiger's stripes remaining visible. That was just as well. I had burned too many of my forms in the past. I didn't want to burn this one. Jerry put Opiz down. They both turned toward me, eyes shining. Black-clad, cruel thugs littered the ground, but Jerry paid them no mind. She walked towards me, head on one side.
Shifter, huh?
Is it that obvious? I said. She laughed. Secret squirrel, huh? I said. Of all the possible reasons for a dangerous babe like her to be working in a place like this, the only one that really made sense to me was that she was secretly employed by Get Out, the General Intelligence Triangle, Outer, humanity's main spy agency. The skin around her eyes tightened for a microsecond, but all she said was, with a smile,
Why would you think something like that?
She squeezed Opizd's small hand.
I'm just a girl trying to run a business with my husband.
And that, too, I thought was the truth. They really did love each other, it was plain to see.
A job,
Jerry went on wryly,
which you have just made a lot harder.
She moved the nearest corpse with her toe and wrinkled her nose.
Do not be ungrateful, Jerry,
Opizd said, scandalized.
They saved our lives.
They did, Jerry conceded. I'm just saying.
I took a deep breath. Well, if it helps, there's something in my ship which may come in handy when their friends come looking for them.
What?
A quarter ton of perfectly ripe bananas. 7. We spent about half an hour helping the Scarvarchis tidy up, a.k.a. shoving all the corpses into the marsh. Then we filed the paperwork. The plesiosaur ship was now mine, free and clear. Jerry said once the registration was safely on its way to the PDL servers.
It comes with a certain, appendage, which I may have forgotten to mention.
We've met it, I said. No problem, I lied. The drone tried to prevent me from getting back on the ship. I was no longer covered with mud, as I had allowed Opiz to turn the hose pipe on me, despite my anxiety about revealing my stripes. But now I was dripping wet.
Out of my freaking way, drone, I growled. Here's a terracentric anthropological factoid for you. When cats are wet, they get bad-tempered.
The drone displayed an emoji of a face blowing a kiss. I squeezed past it and went to shift back to myself.
That thing's going out the airlock as soon as we get into space, I grumbled to Dolph. Machines with egos, can't stand them.
You have a droid nanny for Lucy, Dolph pointed out.
Droid, not drone. There's a big difference.
Nanny D, my daughter's live-in nanny, was a royal blue humanoid who carried out my instructions to the letter. She did not have an ego. That was one difference. Nanny D did not have weapons attachments. That was another difference.
I asked it who was paying its salary, Dolph said. It said it's on sabbatical from the completion.
Just like the ones on Tech Thin.
That was a while back, Mike. I think we should give it a chance.
I ran my hands through my wet hair, pondering whether I was being irrational. I didn't want anything to spoil my lovely new ship, but today had reminded me that Dolph had sound instincts. I might be the boss, but we were a team. I had to listen to him. He handed me a Kroolth-sized towel with the Imperial monogram. I dried my hair and put my clothes on. All right, I said, we'll keep it. As the janitor.
I heard that,
said the drone from the corridor.
Good, I said. Now polish the toilets.
We waved goodbye to Jerry and Opiz and took off. The ship handled even more sweetly than I had hoped. The engines lived up to their awesome specs. The transition from air-fed mode to rocket mode was as smooth as butter. I didn't even have to use the main drive to get orbital, as the empty ship only massed 25 tons. At 180 clicks, I cut the engines. Garongle turned below us, mostly sparkling sea, dotted with small continents that were brown in the middle, green at the edges. A troubled planet. A suffering planet.
Home?
Dolph said. Home, I agreed. But instead of initiating the FTL drive, my right hand hovered above the comms console. I turned to look for the drone. It was floating submissively at the back of the cockpit. We were all floating. There were couches for a pilot and co-pilot, but Dolph and I were never going to get into those unless we shrank 3 feet. At best, they served as hassocks to hook our toes under. I wouldn't be pushing G's until we got human-sized acceleration couches. That ruled out a trip to Silverado, so I decided on the next best thing.